The Guardian.
For the best online debate, go to commentersfree.co.uk.
Hello, this is Georgina Henry, and this is a podcast for Commenters Free. Is our liberty in peril? Do 42 days pre-charge detention, ID cards, and surveillance constitute an assault on our ancient freedoms? The panellists in our debate are David Davis, who was elected a Conservative MP in 1987, has stood for the leadership of the Conservative Party twice in 2001 and 2005, and just over a month ago stunned his party and his parliamentary colleagues by resigning as an MP in order to force a by-election in his seat to provoke a wide debate about the issue of perceived erosion of civil liberties. Dennis McShane, who has been MP for Rotherham since May 1994 and was Minister for Europe in the Foreign Office between 2001 and the reshuffle that followed the 2005 general election. Although he's never been quite sure why he's been dropped from government, he took his sacking in good heart and has continued from the backbenches to loyally support the government, particularly over anti-terror laws and ID cards. Third up will be Henry Porter, who writes a regular column in The Observer, which over the past few years he has turned into a powerful and widely followed platform to chart what he believes is the grotesque erosion of civil liberties in Britain. He has another life as a best-selling and prolific novelist. And finally, David Aronovich, who is a writer, broadcaster and commentator on international politics and the media. His own political journey from Young Communist League and activism in student politics to strong support of the new Labour government has informed much of his writing.
Have your say at commentisfree.guardian.co.uk.
Welcome to the Observer Commenters Free debate about liberty. David.
Good evening. Our tradition of freedom is what gives our society its spirit, our people their genius, and our nation its greatness. Slowly but surely, we are bleeding away those freedoms. British liberty is in peril, and I'm going to give you three examples. First, the extension of pre-charge detention in terrorism cases to 42 days. The right not to be held for prolonged periods without being told the charges against you is a fundamental freedom. At 28 days, we already had the longest period in the free world. So what was the evidence demanding 42 days? There was none. In the last year, police in terrorism cases have not needed more than 14 days, let alone 28 or even 42 days. And in the most complex case we've had, the alleged plot to blow 10 airliners out of the sky at Heathrow in 2006, police had all the evidence on all the suspects easily within 21 days. That's why the country's top prosecution lawyer, the Director of Public Prosecutions, says that they are managing comfortably within 28 days. Now, no one's worried about the time for the real terrorists, so not me. But think of the consequences of being held for so long for the innocent, as half of the people held for 28 days have turned out to be. They may lose their job. The stigma, stress and suffering is immense. The impact on their family, devastating. And because they're innocent, they have no idea why. I don't believe what I think David Aronovich said when he said that he called the guilty you haven't been to prison. We have something in this country called the presumption of innocence. That's what British justice has always stood for. And I hope it always will. My second example is identity cards. First, ministers said identity cards would stop terrorism. But ID cards didn't stop the 9/11 bombers based in Germany, nor the Madrid or the Istanbul attacks. Then they said ID cards will stop illegal immigration. But visitors to this country for up to 3 months won't be required to hold one. Do they seriously expect those who enter Britain illegally after 3 months to turn up to the Home Office? Of course, they should use biometrics to improve visa controls. But what I'm against is the mammoth database that will store 49 different personal details on every citizen clustered in one vulnerable place, creating what Microsoft's National Technology Officer has called a honeypot effect. A hugely attractive and vulnerable target for hackers, fraudsters, and terrorists. Now, I don't trust the government to protect our personal details. After it lost 25 million tax records in the post, who does? But this government's whole attitude needs straightening out. We don't hold our identity on license from them. They hold our personal information on trust from us. And my final example is free speech. Attack now from all sides. We've seen Walter Wolfgang, 82-year-old, detained for shouting nonsense at the Foreign Secretary during a Labour Party conference. Anti-war protesters prosecuted for reading the names of soldiers killed in Iraq by the cenotaph in Whitehall. And most recently, a 15-year-old boy threatened with prosecution just for holding a banner calling Scientology a cult. What possible security grounds are there for gagging an 82-year-old man, two peace activists, and a 15-year-old boy? In each case, 42 days, ID cards, and the assault on free speech, this government has attacked our liberty without improving our security. Each time it happens, it's a victory for the terrorists, not over the terrorists. It's time to take a stand against this arrogant, overbearing, and authoritarian government. It's time to take a stand for the freedom that made our country great. It's time we all took a stand for British liberty. Thank you.
Dennis.
Now, somebody said to me, gosh, the whips will get very cross with you if you're debating with David Davis. And I said, why? He's a great guy. I'm not quite sure about the decision to resign. If Bill Cash, every time he lost a vote on Europe, resigned, we'd have an awful lot of elections in stone. I'm sure if I resigned and said, let's have a by-election in Rotherham, we're giving more money to the working class and the pensioners and the nurses, they'd vote me back massively. But we have a parliamentary democracy. But David feels very passionately on this, and it's to his honour that he's done it. I'm sorry, he, in a sense, because I'm not sure if he'll come back into the shadow cabinet, and I think this pharaonic shadow cabinet of multimillionaires needs an ordinary human being in it. It's quite remarkable how few people connected to the rest of England there are now on the Tory front bench, and one of them, alas, is sitting here today and not on the Tory front bench. Now, on the issue itself, of course people are going to vote this motion through. That's normal. I mean, 30 years ago at a Labour Party conference in Central Hall, they all voted massively to get out of Europe. I think that's still Tory policy. A couple of years ago at a Compass Congress there, the conference there, they had debate about nuclear power. The huge vote, of course, was against nuclear power. I had to speak against it. I'm the bearer of the campaign for lost causes. And I'm not entirely convinced by all of David's arguments. 42 days? Well, actually, it's 28 days at the moment. I think if the principle is that nobody should be detained without charge, that should be true after 28 minutes or 42 hours. But David voted for 28 days. Why is it freedom and liberty up to 28 days and tyranny on the 29th day? David has always been a strong supporter of the Prevention of Terrorism Act. He's voted it and pushed it through the House of Commons. In 1985, 555 people have been detained under the PTA, but only 28 of those have been imprisoned for more than 1 year. I'm sorry, our liberty is also defended sometimes by rattling cages and trying to find out what's going on. If the measure is simply convictions, it won't work. David's spoken against surveillance cameras, CCTV. I have here, David, somebody strongly in support of you, Mr. Derek Hudson of 65 Benton Way, Kimmerworth in Rotherham, who is outraged about the Surveillance Society and calls on me to give you maximum support because of the Hull-Howden junction of the A614, there is one of these wretched surveillance cameras that's taken away after 52 years of a clean driving licence, that record, and he's got 3 points and £60. I do not know, Mr. McShane, whether you're already aware of these facts, but it may be a good idea to bring these to Mr. Davis's attention if he feels so much for the rights of the human being. He might now, if re-elected, like to have all these convictions withdrawn and dismissed, the fines repaid, and the 3 penalty points eradicated if he is re-elected. David, your first task as a new MP. But actually, I'm not too worried, you see, about CCTV cameras. Why? Because my son, 13-year-old, was badly mugged a month ago, and thanks to CCTV, the people who mugged him will now appear in court next month. There's a balance of liberty. Their right to mug my son in freedom, or their right to face surveillance and be caught. There are 44,000 convictions under detections under DNA. We have an outrageous record in this country of detecting and convicting people accused of rape. We have 18,000 sex slaves, young girls under the age of 18, trafficked in to Britain, according to all of today's papers. I quote The Guardian and The Independent, so I assume it must be true. Some of us believe that we have to actually say to men, will you please limit some of your freedom to as much paid sex as possible? Yes, erode your liberty. Some of us say the demand side of this sex slave traffic needs to be trafficked. Who attacks us? Henry Porter attacked me in The Observer, saying that men should have no limit on their liberty to pay for sex under conditions that frankly degrade women. So too did my dear friend on the right, David Aronovich. So we're all a bit conflicted on this. The balance eternally between two kinds of liberty, the liberty of workers not to be overworked, the liberty of bosses to say, no, you should work 50 or 60 hours a day, the liberty of people to own property as they wish, to have pay for whatever they like if they've got the money, the liberty that says, no, we've got a broader community and social responsibility. So on issues like DNA and CCTV, and even, I think, on the need to have adequate time if the police demand it, if the Director of Public Prosecution authorises it, if independent judges agree it, if Parliament votes for it. Because we're not talking about 42 days, we're talking about an extension of 2 weeks. And all these new conditions are now put in there to ensure that it's not unfair. On ID cards, well, yes, I could be conflicted on that. Nick Clegg says he will resign Parliament or burn his ID card, but Nick's married to a lovely Spanish lady. His mother is Dutch. He's worked in France and Belgium. The Netherlands, Spain, France and Belgium all have ID card systems. In Belgium, it's compulsory to carry one with you. So when he lived and worked there, he had no problems with it. It's a problem when it comes to living and working in Britain. I consider that Liberal Democrat hypocrisy. And since there are no Liberal Democrats on the platform, there's no problem in me saying that. But actually, if we want an open society, if we want no closed frontiers, I don't have any problems with saying that the democratically elected authorities of the nation should have the same rights to know things about you as my mobile phone, my credit card. That tells the private capitalist system infinitely more about me. Yes, I can throw away my mobile phone. Yes, I don't have to have a credit card. Yes, I don't have to breathe. I don't have to drive. But if you actually want to live in the modern world, then I'm afraid you're surrendering information about yourself far more rapidly, far more out of control, because it's sold and exchanged and bartered than anything that might happen on within a government setup. I actually think it would be a good idea if our citizens could go into their, see their doctor, you could press a button and call up a record of their illnesses. I don't see that as a surrender of liberty. I think that's an increase of liberty of having a doctor who actually knows the full medical record of the person he's dealing with. So forgive me if I'm not convinced of the argument. Were David to say abolish the Prevention of Terrorism Act, were David to say abolish 28 days, then I think he would have a very strong case. But he's not doing that. He believes in it sincerely. I respect his motives, and I, you know, I wish him well. I look forward to him coming back to Parliament. But there are other liberties. The liberties not to be hanged by the neck until you're dead. offered under false charges. But David supports capital punishment. The liberty, if you're gay, not to face oppression in school. But David voted for Section 28 and has continued to vote it. So, friends, liberty is not my conception of liberty or David's conception of liberty. It is a confusing thing. As Milton said, when they cry liberty, they often mean license. I don't believe David falls into that trap. But be careful. We have a responsibility to protect the liberty of our citizens. And one of those liberties is not to be blown up. I wish we didn't need a PTA. I wish we didn't need any measures, 28 days or 28 hours. They're there because Parliament's debated and thought hard about this and thinks the liberty of the citizen not to face potential explosions in the tube and elsewhere. And believe me, people are out there planning to do just that as I speak, is something that requires, yes, a little less liberty for the people detained under the fears and worries that we have, a little more liberty for the citizens of Britain to sleep a little safer in their beds each night. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. That's why we're in such a mess, Dennis. I just want to reply to a couple of points. Dennis accused me of saying I wanted to give men the right to buy sex. I just might point out that I was actually making the point that I'd like to be able to give women the right to sell sex, and it was nothing to do with me or the government whether they did. An event like this in Edinburgh 7 months ago, Lord Faulkner and I were on either side, different sides. He lost, I won, but his Scottish colleagues duffed me up. And we walked back to the hotel together, and he's an impressive figure, Charlie Faulkner. I liked him. And he stood under a street light. This is about 9:30 after a long dinner, actually a little later, and he said, "But surely you feel free, Henry?" And I said, "Charlie, just look around here, will you?" We were under three CCTV cameras. And the fact is, I don't feel free. And that's because I know what this government has done. We people, me and David, and others like us, Shami Chakrabarti and so forth, are constantly treated with a sort of condescending air that we, first of all, don't understand the dangers of the 21st century, that we are deluded about what's really out there, that we're vain in trying to propose ourselves as heroes, that we're self-congratulatory, or members, as in Polly Toynbee's case, of the pampered bourgeoisie looking for victimhood. Well, I'm none of these, actually. I would be rather, to tell you the truth, writing my novels. But when Roger Orton asked me to try a few columns for The Observer, I started to look at what the law was. I read the law, and I was astounded by it. And the reason that the paper has received many complaints about me, but I've never been done on accuracy. And that is because all this is in the statute book. Now, I could go on about rights. I'm not going to go on about rights tonight, but I'm going to talk about the database state, which I think is the greatest threat to our liberty and to our society and to British civilization, as a matter of fact. And I want to just underline one point. Now, we are the most advanced country in this respect, in the world, certainly in the Western world. I wouldn't necessarily exclude North Korea, but I think perhaps on grounds of money and technology, we are the most advanced surveyed society. The project to create this very controlled state, which would have pleased, by the way, the East German Stasi. I mean, the East German Stasi, with this material and this technology at hand, would have ensured that no revolution ever took place 19 years ago in November 1989. I just want to go through a few of the things that we've got, we've let slide by, that we've accepted as part of our life to protect us either from crime or terrorism. David's mentioned the ID card. Well, that, of course, is at the core of the project. No one after the ID card comes in and we're all registering every transaction and our identity every time we need any service or buy an airline ticket or so forth. Nobody will have the privacy that they had and I have, and you have all grown up with. That will have gone. that will have gone forever. But let me just rehearse some of the other things that you have let slip by, or I have, and Parliament certainly has. Some of them not even debated in Parliament, just the subject of statutory instruments, which are basically ministerial decrees, as we all know. ANPR cameras now everywhere on every motorway and in every town centre. It is impossible to make a car journey, truck journey, tractor journey without that, without your registration plate being picked up and retained for 2 years, that information. 19 pieces of information are now required, or will be, by the Home Secretary when you leave this country. And that is not just simple information like the time you leave, but it's about your credit card, your itinerary, your mobile phone number, the spread of CCTV. We're often mocked, people in my camp, about worrying about CCTV, but actually, you know, this is a real danger. Maybe 80% of it doesn't work and is useless to the police. But the point I want to get over is that we are building this apparatus, this vast network of surveillance, which may not be very effective now, but in 10 years' time, with the processing power, with the problems we're going to have, global warming, recession, whatever it might be, the pressure to use this to control people will be enormous. And we should all take home one message, that this technological apparatus, which I refer to, is very, very dangerous, not just for us, but for our children and grandchildren. Communications. The government now takes 500,000... intercepts half a million emails, internet connections, and regular mail every year. That's the last figure. It's probably going up, but I can't say that for definite. Local councils now mount surveillance operations a la MI5. People creeping around in vans, taking pictures, intercepting emails. And what for? Fly tippers. People who let their dogs defecate in the wrong place. People whose children are suspected of... applications for school are suspected to be fraudulent in some way. That's the kind of society we're building, a snooping, spying society. The government has now a statutory instrument passed just or announced just before the holidays last August, access to all phone records. Now Hazel Blair suddenly announces something rather, I just want to get the title right, community tension monitoring, which will ask for reports on named troublemakers whose political activities, underline that please, political activities are considered to be causing community tension. I mean, you couldn't have found a sentence which better captures the bossiness, the intrusion, the incompetence of this government. And the idea that any political activities should be monitored by local councils is just horrific, but we've let it go. Let's not forget what they're doing with children's databases. There are four children's databases, including the most sinister, which is called Contact Point, which was delayed after the Majesty's Revenue and Customs loss of 25 million records. But it will come, and it will contain the details, the contacts between agencies and children, the references to parenting and parenting orders and people's suitability of parents for the rest of that child's life, accessible by those in the state, but not by the parents. The parents can't say, I contest that information. The information is on record forever. It's the state. It's owned by the state. We have 5.2% of the British population on a DNA database. Now, there are good arguments for DNA, but let us not forget the principle of innocence until proven guilty in a normal court of law. If we are to have a DNA database, which, by the way, has many class and race biases contained in it, then let's have a debate in Parliament. Let's actually, in my mind, let's have a vote on the country, a plebiscite, a referendum on this very issue, because it is so essential. We are at the beginning of DNA science. We have no idea where it will lead. We have no idea of the profiling that takes place with these samples or the experiments of research done on people's likelihood. After all, the government is already introducing surveys of the 50 most... each borough now has been asked to return figures. The 50 children most likely to turn into criminals. They have to report secretly and pass the figures up for suggested intervention later on. I could go on. But let me just tell you, let's just ask where this information goes to. This information is being accrued in the centre of our government, in our country, in a project called Transformational Government, where all databases are merging. The information will be shared vertically and horizontally. And it will also be shared with European agencies, and now, owing to an agreement about to be made, with the US. So that means that police forces from Calabria to Langley, Virginia, or New York will have access to your details if they so wish. The one person who doesn't have any access to your details is, of course, you. And that does tell us something very, very important about the way our society, or at least the way our government, thinks of us. Your personal information is now the government's. It's the government's to do with what the government wishes. And that's an important shift that has taken place over the last 10 years, and I think defines Labour's attitude to you and to the people, that you are in some way much more subjects than you were a decade ago. I just would like to end on two points. The first point is, how can we trust the government? Well, we're asked to trust the government endlessly by these two, and by Lord Faulkner and anyone else actually one talks to. I said, trust the government. The government's benign. Actually, I happen to agree that most people in government are benign. And I happen to agree that most politicians are benign. And I think they do a jolly good job and are mostly underrated for it. Nonetheless, this project does mean that we have to put enormous trust in those people. And I simply don't think they've merited it. Look at what happened to 25 million records. Look at what happened to the Criminal Records Bureau. Look at what happened to the NH records in Guildford. Look at what happened to DVLC records. There are suitcases, laptops, turning up almost on a weekly basis with our personal information in it. It is not secure. It never can be secure. And we simply shouldn't trust the government. Now, I just want to end on a question for David. David, during the Iraq War, said, actually, I rather admired David's stand in the Iraq War. I've been to many debates featuring David, and I've always rather admired the way he robustly defended his position. But I just would like to put this to him. He said about WMD, if nothing is eventually found, I will never believe another thing that I am told by our government or that of the US ever again. And more to the point, neither will anyone else. I wanted to know from David, and if he could possibly answer this question, I'd very much like it. What has changed his mind? Thank you so much.
David.
One of the things that's always a good idea in society is to have strong and vociferous anti-war and pro-civil liberties movements. It's much better to have those as major movements in a society than to have strong pro-war and strong anti-civil liberties organisations. So, in a sense, this is precisely the kind of area of discussion we should be having and debate that I welcome. And I don't at all feel antagonistic towards David Davis or even, given his last comment, to Henry Porter for raising the question in the way they do. It is absolutely essential that it is raised, it is discussed, and so on. And I want to pay some tribute here to the work that the Civil Liberties Lobby have done. I think in Shami Chakrabarti, as I've written, we have probably the most effective public lobbyist who's been operating since Des Wilson. And I mention Shami despite the very real risk of being cited in some form of libel trial. The British libel laws being one of our great and glorious ancient freedoms, which effectively stop journalists and other people saying the truth about people and have done for year after year after year. I'm slightly surprised not to find the libel laws cited here as an infringement of our freedom, but then, of course, they're such an ancient infringement of our freedom, and I do understand that we're only dealing with recent infringements of our freedoms. The old ones were perfectly all right. It's the new ones that we have to worry about. And one of the things that we should kind of recognise, actually, and this is the point that Dennis made, is that the attitude that we take to what constitutes freedoms and what moves into and out of the areas that states take a view on and where they try to circumscribe or liberate people changes over time, as we've seen with the question of the control over your own fertility, something that people are continuously attempting still to try and restrict, or about people's own private sexual behaviour. There are a large number of people who still believe that the state has a role getting into people's bedroom and telling them who they may and who they may not sleep with, and yet do not somehow see that as some form of infringement of personal liberty. Now, I have to say, we can disagree about what constitutes in this situation a personal liberty, and we clearly do. But the point that I think that we've reached in part of this discussion, frankly, is I think we have reached a point almost of hysteria about this civil liberties question, or rather a section of British society has begun to reach a point of hysteria. I think it's partly to do with what's happened since 9/11 and the tone of the discussion about terrorism. I think it is also partially to do with, as Polly Toynbee has said, a kind of absence of ideological placement for a section of the radical middle classes to kind of go along with. So it's tended, in a way, to try and find this by default to batten onto. And the reason why I say this is not because you cannot find examples of absurdities in the way, say, local governments operate or national governments operate, or in terms of lost records, and you would find those same absurdities in the way that individuals operate or in the way that large companies operate and so on. That's not the point. The point is that you get to the situation whereby a proposition is being placed before you about how society, British society, is developing, which is simply not true. It is, in my opinion, a paranoid fantasy. And we've heard two elements of it this evening. Let me give you one element. It comes from David Davis's own website, where he says, apropos of everything else, this has become a society in which, quote, neighbourhood spies follow our children home from school and investigate a range of trivial misdemeanours. Now, neighbourhood spies don't follow our children home from school. We have a couple of cases that we know about where families have been spied upon to discover whether or not they lived close to, or they lived within a catchment area. And you can argue about whether or not this is a proper thing for people to do. Although I have to tell you that debates in the area where people are accused of doing such things are actually slightly more, you know, they're more heated than what I might imagine. But as a general proposition about British society, the idea that neighbourhood spies follow our children home from school is ludicrous. We are not East Germany, and that does not happen. Likewise, when Henry says that he walks down the centre street and says, because the CCTV cameras, which he sees as being a vast network, they're not a vast network. Most of them are never connected to each other and never will be actually interconnected to each other. This is actually, and this is where we'll come back to later, is one of David Davis's major complaints, and therefore actually, in fact, forms a major distinction and difference between David Davis and Henry Porter, which one at one point in this discussion I'd like to see reconciled in some kind of way, because at the moment you can't. David's position is not that we have too many CCTV cameras, although actually in his manifesto he said, in his great statement about Magna Carta, etc., he said that we are becoming a bad society because, and one of his comments was, a CCTV camera for every 14 citizens. But then he goes on to say, I'm not against CCTV, but if it's going to be used, the camera should be able to provide clear images. In other words, the cameras that make Henry Porter feel unfree because they're there, David Davis doesn't object to them, he just thinks that they should be clearer and give better evidential standards. In other words, we should be able to see a better picture of Henry Porter as he walks around Edinburgh or Glasgow or wherever he was. But actually, of course, the cameras aren't following him everywhere. He isn't unfree because the cameras can see him any more than because cameras can now pick up where your registration, your license plate is, you are more unfree than when a copper had to do it by writing the note down. What on earth, folks, do you think the license plate was put on cars for? It was for identifying them. Why did we have photographs in our passports? We put photographs in our passports so that the bosses, so that the people at the border could tell whether you were that person or not. When you move to biometrics, all you're saying is, I'm going to have a more effective way of doing the thing that I used to do badly before. So that's one kind of area of argument, I think, which is strange. But I think Henry gave it away. When talking about the CCTV, he sort of mentioned these sort of mild things that people are now being caught for CCTV, and he mentioned fly tipping. Fly tipping is not a mild thing if it happens near you. It just isn't. And the use of CCTV to locate fly tippers is a very important thing. And when you've had a whole lot of fly tipping going on outside your house, you soon appreciate the benefit of it. Let's take, just from this week, an example of a CCTV camera in my area. Local paper says, residents of a particular block want a CCTV camera put in their lift. Why? Is it because they want to spy upon their neighbours? No, it's because somebody's been taking a dump every night in their lifts. Shall I tell you how intolerable a way that is of living when every time you get into the lift, somebody's crapped in it? So do they feel spied upon? No, they don't feel spied upon. They feel that this is some way of actually maybe trying to catch the person who takes a dump in the lift. This is not some huge invasion of privacy. And by the way, nor are the photographs being taken in that lift beamed straight through to Gordon Brown Central, somewhere in number 10, where he can spot who's taking a dump, or even worse, who's not taking a dump in the lift round the corner. This is a paranoid fantasy. We then go to the DNA database. Oh, I have a real problem with this, because not just because David Davis stood on a Conservative Party manifesto in 1997 that said that it would expand its CCTV camera coverage and also the DNA database. I have a problem with this because it is actually a fairly kind of fundamental argument. You asked me, David, who I meant by the guilty unimprisoned. I'm amazed you have to ask me that. The guilty unimprisoned are the people who haven't gone to prison for all the offences that have been committed for which nobody has been caught or charged. That's who they are. The fact that they weren't charged and they didn't go to prison didn't mean somehow these crimes weren't committed. That's a remarkable position for a Conservative former shadow Home Secretary to occupy. We know, you quite often not with strangers, but nevertheless quite often with strangers, that our rape conviction rate follows well, and even our rape charging rate falls well below the level of the number of rapes. I mean, actually a kind of tiny percentage. Those rapes were committed even if nobody went to prison for them. So one of the possibilities of a DNA database is that it is going to help catch, say, rapists who haven't previously been caught. Now, we know David's own view about the DNA database is that it should be extended retrospectively to former prisoners. So that means that if you went to prison for defaulting on paying your fine for a TV licence, you would be have your DNA taken. This is incidentally impossible. You just do realise that, don't you? It's impossible to actually do that, which is one of the reasons why Lord Chief Justice Sedley, why Judge Sedley said that we would have to move under those circumstances to a universal DNA database because it wasn't discriminatory. We couldn't effectively just have a DNA database that took retrospective prisoners and current prisoners and so on. Am I trespassing on my time? Oh, another minute. Okay, right, fair enough. Well, that means 10 minutes in anybody's language.
Not in mine.
No, and not in yours. So I want to make a point very, very quickly. I think that the problem is not so much with something like ID cards, with something like the DNA database, where I'm quite happy to trad my information held there. There are plenty of cases of people who, like the Dern Valley rapist, was caught by his sister's DNA, which was taken from a swab as a consequence of her failing a breath test. She wouldn't get in under David's system. So under your system, David, that you want, that rapist would still be free. Now, you have to take that one on the chin, just as I have to take the one on the chin that says I'm going to offer my DNA up and I'm going to allow it to sit there on the database, believing that the checks and balances that we have within the system will protect me from wrongful use of that DNA, just so, and you believe it may not, you have to accept that that particular rapist doesn't get caught. But what worries me more, that's why I'm in favour of a universal ID card and a universal DNA base, because what I see happening, if that doesn't happen, is the sort of thing that's beginning to happen in Italy, where they send the police in to a refugee camp in order to get the fingerprints of a specific section of society. In other words, what I'm saying is that these things, these giving up these bits of information, are actually the duties of citizens, as citizens also accrue rights. And what they effectively help to do is to protect minorities from what inevitably happens at times of tension, which is the demand that the full wrath of the state be turned only on them. So in other words, what I'm saying is, liberty in peril, the liberty of the majority is not in peril. But what comes into peril at certain times, unless we have some form of universal provision, is the liberty of minorities. That's always, always much more in question.
Just before we open it up to all of you, perhaps we'll get the panel to respond to some of the points made on each side. I mean, there was a lot said to you, David, there. But I'm interested in just picking up one point that both over here have made, which is really about your definition of liberty and how it doesn't extend to gay rights or the women's right to choose over their bodies, et cetera, et cetera, and that actually it's very narrowly drawn around very specific issues. And that in itself is contradictory.
Sure. No, I do take that point. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this is this wonderful sort of authoritarian conformism that if you take a view on one aspect of liberty, you have to fit everybody else's view or everybody else's stereotype of the sort of person that takes that stance. I actually have the one point was raised was the question of capital punishment, for example. Now, and it's been said any number of times, I campaign on capital punishment. I've never actually made a speech on the subject. But I do think when I'm asked a question about capital punishment, I should give what I think is the correct answer. And it's a moral question, because it's never going to happen in our lifetime. And it's never going to happen if I were ever to be Home Secretary. That's clearly not going to happen now. It's never going to happen as a result of that. But I was asked that question. So I thought, well, does the state have a moral right to take life when there's an evil act being, or several evil acts being committed on several different occasions, and you've got overwhelming evidence? The answer was yes. Just as David's view that it was right to go to war means the state taking life too. So there are a whole series of areas where we will have different views on what are important liberties. My views are liberties that relate to the innocent are very important. Now let me just pick up a couple of points that David did say. He went on about this guilty unimprisoned. Now, the guilty unimprisoned, these are people who have not been caught for crimes. And on the basis of this, he wants to treat everybody as a suspect. That's what it amounts to. Not only to a rational basis, but everybody who's already on the database, they should stay there because they might actually help us solve some crimes. Well, in maybe 100 cases for a million people on there. If we went back and put on the DNA database the people who have been proven guilty of crimes previously, and he's wrong about the discriminatory argument, by the way, if we went and put back on the DNA database people who have been in prison for crimes, then we would actually solve thousands, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of crimes without impinging on the innocent. So that's point number one. It's a very, very important point. Here we have a state where we penalise the innocent and we let off the guilty. And that, in my view, is a major injustice. Second point about the nature of state. We're not in a tyrannical dictatorship. Nobody believes that. At least I hope nobody believes that. But that doesn't mean the temptation to misuse data isn't there. I don't know how many of you remember Rose Addis being accused of racism, an 82-year-old lady in a hospital bed at the time, or Pam Warren, the rail safety campaigner, where special advisers asked for facts about her sexual and political history so they might slur her. Or Martin Sixsmith, when he was fired from government, when he was subject to financial slurs. The temptations to misuse data in a state can often be enormous. And you must think to yourself, what will actually happen, not in a dictatorship, but when all your data is in one place and too easy to get hold of? That's a really, really serious issue, which both the speakers, I'm afraid, against this motion, have skated over.
Well, Dennis, have I just turned that off? No. Dennis, can you pick that up? Because it's not just, the temptation to misuse it. It's the fact that you keep losing it. And, liberty is the right not to have your data lost by a careless government, isn't it?
It sure is, but I'm actually more worried about the amount of data held by private companies, which none of us seem to want to discuss, that is bartered, sold, exchanged around the world, made available to agencies around the world, over which we have very, very little control. David is right, of course, to highlight any abuse, but believe me, these abuses happen well before CCTV cameras, DNA, questions of ID cards. Governments do wicked things to innocent people. That's not a function of this debate. The real issue is, and we're all conflicted on it, permanently conflicted between the civil liberties argument and the question of the right of, as I say, citizens to have their freedom, my son to have the right to think that the people who beat him up might face justice. Afraid it was done thanks with the help of CCTV cameras. Well, what do you want? My son not to have justice? The kids who beat him up to get off scot-free? Or I hope they don't go to prison. I hope simply they have a good talking to. But those are real core decisions. And the questions I'd like to put, which David, my colleague David, Timmy Davis at this table, hasn't answered, is why is 28 days freedom and 29 days tyranny? Why is the Prevention of Terrorism Act not also an unacceptable infringement of the rights that he is talking about? Is my constituent right that you should have the freedom to drive down the roads of Britain without surveillance?
Henry, why don't you pick that point up?
Yeah, okay, make a few points. The whole point about ANPR cameras, automatic number recognition cameras, is that, of course, we're at the beginning of this technology. Just at the beginning. And I have every right to travel around this country, well, the government doesn't think so, but I believe I do, without these movements being tracked. And the practical reason for this is that when we hit rough times, the government feels it's being opposed by people that it would rather not be opposed by, there will be real-time tracking of people coming to London to demonstrate. Now, you say, I may be a fantasist, but the fact of the matter is, if you looked at the behaviour of the police during demonstrations against the Iraq War and during demonstrations against arms sales, various arms fairs in around the country, you will see that they do not behave like a democratic police force. And that's because they have the ability to track buses. The point I made about surveillance operations and the local councils, can I just finish this? And local councils, it's not just about CCTV. These councils are employing groups of people running around in vans, intercepting emails. It's a question of proportion. What sort of society do we... I mean, in my view, the two people whose child was applied to the school, the catchment area issue, those two people were much more offended than ever offended. Their offence was nothing, not even potentially so, compared to what was done to them. David didn't answer the point about trust. If we are to have all this technology and all this great apparatus of surveillance, we then have to ask who we're going to trust with it, what we're going to trust, who we're going to trust in 10 years. Because as this David said, the temptation to misuse it all is tremendous. Now, I just want to add one point here, and I know I've gone on too long, but I will just add that the one thing we do need, and I cannot understand why Labour government, well, I do understand why the government hasn't introduced it, but I don't understand why Parliament hasn't thought of it more, and that is a Privacy Act. And that is a Privacy Act which covers Dennis's worries about corporate information, the way that is seized from you without your knowledge and distributed around the world and used against your will and without your knowledge, and also controls the state. And the way I do that was to embed this Act in a Bill of Rights, which is placed beyond Parliament's control and Parliament's desire to constantly fiddle with our liberties.
Can I just ask David to pick up this point? About trust in government and whether or not is your view of the state that it is benign, whichever government? And if it's a different government, is that a problem?
No, it is a problem. I made when I wrote about this very recently, I said something which was misunderstood as referring to David Davis, where it most certainly didn't. But the problem with the surveillance state, with a state... with a dictatorship, or rather with, let's take a sort of, you know, a fascist state or a Stalinist state. The problem is not that they use the latest surveillance techniques. That isn't the problem. And actually, you're wrong, because the North Koreans, of course, can't use the latest surveillance techniques because their society is so buggered by their incredible Stalinism that they haven't got the capacity to use technology like that or to invent or even to develop it. I think the point at which the problem happens is the point at which you decide to support racist, scapegoating, populist parties in elections. And that's the point. Everything else follows from that. The misuse of whatever you've got, But if they're not going to misuse your database, then they're just going to go into the villages with the P or the towns with the wrong people in them, burn them out, burn the books, and so on. That's the problem. The problem is an ideological one. It's not a technical one. And actually, this danger all the time of becoming a technical rather than an ideological argument about, you know, I can imagine all kinds of safeguards which we could. And so I'm not even against Henry's Bill of Rights, by the way. I'm not even totally sure I'm in favour of the 42 days. I'm fairly agnostic about that. But what I am fairly sure about is that I don't think there is a very big danger per se from us having a national DNA database or for us having a national ID card, which actually does what passports should do, but they don't work. And this comes back to the issue of trust since you raised it. There's always one thing which is raised about me, which is this one piece of thing that I wrote in the April of 2003 about WMD, and which I 1 year later said was the stupidest thing that I'd ever written. And when you've written a really stupid thing, I've written about three things that I cringe to hear, and that's always one of them, and so on. And Henry will later share with us his three things that he cringes about in a kind of spirit of free interchange. But one of the reasons I changed my mind was when I saw the evidence that was presented, the evidence, mind, at both the Hutton inquiry and the Butler inquiry, I realised that the government had actually had reason to believe that there was WMD in Iraq. Now, I'm not going to... That's not the main point here. The main point here is I also realised something else. A degree of information was given up at the Hutton inquiries and the Butler inquiries, which no government has ever given up before. We discovered things about the details of Joint Intelligence Committee reports which we had never previously known, and the world did not collapse in on us, which made me believe that there should be a much more thoroughgoing Freedom of Information Act, and this nonsense about not being able to say what civil servants, advisers, ministers, etc. should in effect go. In other words, I've always felt that there is another side to this which should be insisted upon. But by and large, yes, I do think, on the whole, we can trust democratic politicians in this country, by and large. It doesn't mean you don't need strong civil liberties, you don't need strong safeguards on your databases and things like that. All these are perfectly sensible things to do.
Right, should we open it up to...
There's a tiny point of news, Georgia. On the news tonight, it said a US judge, this is referring to Henry's view, if you have a constitution, a bill of rights, you're protected, has said that anybody who's logged on ever to YouTube, their details have to be released to Google. This is the fight between Google and the people who put things on YouTube who want, you know, their percentage share of if it's a bit of film or pop music or whatever. Now, a judge has said that literally hundreds of millions of people around the world now have to have their details released to a private company. So the notion that a constitutional or a bill of rights system or the judges being in charge protect your privacy, I'm afraid, just isn't true.
That's one other thing for the government to do.
Hi, thank you. Anthony Barnett from Open Democracy. I'd like to ask a question to Dennis McShane in particular, because he's been generous enough to say that those of us who support, broadly speaking, the arguments that David Davis and Henry Porter have been forward, that we're contested rather than simply being paranoid. And you made this point that in our society now, it may be necessary at times to shake the bars. And I quite take the point that terrorism presents a particular problem to the security services in that they need to make preemptive arrests. And therefore, when, for example, if they do, or they're fortunate enough to discover a plot before it's happened, or they discover a plot, and they go into a street, they will arrest everybody in the house, right? And we know that, as the independent investigator said, they exercise an abundance of caution. Over half those arrested under the terrorism legislation are innocent. And it then becomes, it seems to me, an obligation on the security forces, on the police, to release the innocent as soon as possible. The argument should be going the other way. Now, the critical issue here is that we need those people who are in the communities, close to those who are, so to speak, attracted by the glamour of terrorism, to become informers, to alert us, to feel they're part of that. That's a critical issue of the need of an anti-terrorism policy. And to do that, we have to stand for justice and make that clear. Now, A critical issue here is that there needs to be some kind of consensus in the society. These are our rules. We have debated changing them. This is where we've got to, and this is what we stand for, and you should be able to join us. Isn't it clear now with the, in effect, squalid scenes in the House of Commons, which happened when the government won that vote on 42 days, that if it is defeated by the Lords and it then goes back to the Commons to be pushed through under the Parliament Act, we need Labour MPs of intelligence and integrity, or some intelligence, some integrity, I'm looking in your direction, to stand up and say, whatever the arguments are, we don't have consensus on pushing this through. We've got to say, fine, we're going to accept the limit of 28 days. And would you think of doing that?
The point about being a populist government is that you're meant to be popular, so I don't think it's working. The Prevention of Terrorism Act is derived actually from the Emergency Powers Act, rushed through in 1 hour's debate in 1939 when the war started, as was the Prevention of Terrorism Act. This has been contested very thoroughly, and Anthony's quite right, the House of Lords may send it back. I'm not quite sure what will happen then. But I think it's better, you see, that we have this very unpleasant and conflicted debate. I'm conflicted on this now. Then we wait for the next atrocity and then rush through something, as the EPA and the PTA were rushed through, without any real consideration. A bit of prevention perhaps being better than cure.
But what about his heart's and mind's point, really?
The heart and mind point is also kind of... I mean, I have 10,000 dear friends who are Muslim constituents in my constituency. Believe me, I don't want to speak for them, they have to speak for themselves. They would want different aspects of government policy in many different areas, of course, especially on foreign policy. But they actually know the incredible damage that is done to that community. They're not prepared to be informers, I don't think, Henry. I don't think the Irish people are informers. These are infinitesimally small group of people whose heads are scrambled.
David, did you want to come back on that?
Yeah, can I just pick up one point Andy Barnett made? He said something which I thought was very important and we sort of slipped by in this discussion. He said that the duty of the state was to release innocent people as soon as possible. And, of course, he is exactly right. But one of the effects of this legislation is to do exactly the opposite. If you are a conscientious policeman and you've picked up, let's say, 25 suspects or thereabouts, what you do is you focus on the ones who are most dangerous first. You focus on the ones where there's most evidence first. So, in the alleged Heathrow plot, all of those charged with conspiracy to murder, the most serious charge, were charged before 21 days, most of them before 14. The last ones to be charged were charged with a lower charge of acts preparatory to terrorism. But then also there were three innocent people. The innocent people get pushed to the back by policemen behaving entirely properly, by prosecutors behaving entirely properly. So you have the outcome of this well-intended law is that we keep more innocent people in longer than we do guilty people without charging them. And it's a very, very serious failure. And if we go to 42 days, it'll probably be a majority of innocent people who are kept to 42 days. And what will that do to the reaction, for example, of the decent, moderate Muslim community when they see decent, moderate Muslims held for 42 days without a charge and actually without any guilt whatsoever?
Hello, my name is Anna Mayle, and I'm quite concerned about civil liberties generally, in particular this anti-terror bill. My feeling is probably that the Lords might kick it back, but ultimately, using the Parliament Act, it will get forced through. My question is, what happens next? Is there any hope for people who care about civil liberties in the Human Rights Act? Does Article 8, right to private life, help us at all? What's the next step? Thank you.
One of the things we should recognise, we haven't mentioned it, is that one of the major gains for civil liberties in the last few years has been the incorporation into British law of the Human Rights Act, of the Human Rights Charter. And that has meant some significant changes. I mean, I think I'm right in saying, David, you wish to reverse that, and Henry, you'd be wanting to keep it. Am I correct?
We want a Bill of Rights.
I've got a bit of rights.
And the Human Rights Act hasn't protected us at all over the last 10 years. So.
Sorry, I can't hear.
The Human Rights Act hasn't protected us at all over the last 10 years.
I fundamentally disagree with this, but one of the things it's certainly helped to do is make it very, very difficult, and other legislation as well, to deport people who almost certainly are people who have malintentions towards either this country or to countries with whom we are allied and would like to commit acts of terrorism. And that's just, that's an unfortunate fact. And we have a very great difficulty, a greater difficulty than other countries have, in deporting people from this country who we don't particularly approve of. Now, you may consider that to be a good thing or a bad thing, but I note that one of the inhabitants of Belmarsh, who has actually been there for 7 years, has now been released, but under terms of incredible strictness and so on, as an Algerian person. I think that just emphasises the difficulties, and rather than just placing it in terms of trust of government, I mean, I think you have to say is that we've faced some real difficulties, and that comes back to Anthony Barnett's really important point, and it's a point I do agree with, about one of the big problems that the government has courted in the way in which it's handled anti-terror legislation is by giving the impression of arbitrariness. I certainly agree with the notion, and that, to that extent, that's why I'm agnostic about 42 days to a significant extent. I think you have to make sure that people cannot level the charge of arbitrariness at your legal procedures. I think that's a real, real danger, particularly in conditions when a kind of a populist desire to be seen to be doing things can motivate governments. I agree with that too. But I am worried, nevertheless, about something that David Davis said, which is the notion that it's simply a rule that the important people are the people that you'll charge first and so on. I mean, we saw during the Dhiren Barrett case that actually on the police surveillance at that point was Mohammed Siddiqui Khan. They didn't have the capacity to go after Mohammed Siddiqui Khan. Maybe they might have done at that point. If they had, it may very well have been that he would have been less guilty than Dhiren Barrett of the crimes which Dhiren Barrett was being charged with. That doesn't mean that he didn't represent a very significant danger, even if the charges against him, because he hadn't at that moment managed to blow anything up, would have been very much less. We simply don't know, but it is a very real difficulty. And we talk about this area sometimes as if there aren't very real difficulties.
Quickly, on the Human Rights Act, the right to respect for private and family life, home and correspondence is clearly not guaranteed in this country. That, I think, is Article 8, isn't it? So, yes, we need a proper Bill of Rights, in my view, which in some way incorporates the Human Rights Act and takes it further and is entrenched. What happens in Parliament with 42 days? It probably take about a year. So that means there's a year-long fight and there's a year opportunity to persuade increasing number of brave, heroic Labour MPs not to take knighthoods and to vote for what is right.
For the best online debate, go to commentisfree.co.uk.
The debate was lively with four very strong personalities and some interesting questions from the floor. At the beginning, we took a vote which showed that solidly the hall was in favour of the motion that our liberty was in peril. David Aronovich and Dennis McShane had a lot of work to do to persuade people otherwise. At the end of the debate, when we took a vote to see whether or not the audience had been moved by their arguments, they'd added one or two others to their side, but broadly the audience came down in favour of the motion, our liberty is in peril.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.